Here we are, Common Sense Ohio year-end episode. That means it is actually 12/31/25, which makes tomorrow 1/1/26. Just like that, we're flipping the script and starting over. Lots to talk about. It's not just that there's football happening. It's not just that Ohio State is in the playoffs again against Miami. It's not just that we have fraud rampant around the country. We have a special guest in the studio, Matthew Ryan Palmer, private Matthew Ryan Palmer, here on HBL.
Holiday block leave.
HBL. Holiday block leave. We'll talk about that and his experience with basic training and just get the Army perspective. My son, as it turns out, wearing his Ohio State gear appropriately. So look, you know, every go Bucks. That's right. So every show I try to do a fact. What this day in history? I don't have my computer, by the way. It's my phone. Matt distracted me this morning. Anyway, I was curious why January 1 became the new year. Like, why not October 1? What, in other words, why the origin of the calendar? And I knew it had something to do with the ancients, and it did, in fact. January 1 became the new year due to ancient Roman traditions, specifically honoring Janus. Now, Janus is not, that's J-N-U-S. We're not talking Joplin here.
Right, right. And I think Janus was a god with two faces.
Was she?
He.
Yeah.
It's a dude named Janus.
Well, I'm talking Janis Joplin.
Yeah, right.
So I, for whatever reason, I had Janus as a female. But anyway, Janus, their god of the beginnings, with the month named after him. You're right. Julius Caesar formalized this in his Julian calendar around 45 BCE, which is now we know before Christ existed, making it the first day for new consuls. And then Pope Gregory the 13th solidified it in the Gregorian calendar around or in 1582, became a global standard, aligning with the new beginnings after the winter solstice when the days start to grow longer. So January 1 is tomorrow. This is our year-end episode. I've been off for a while. Norm, you were out traveling around?
Yeah. I decided to I'm writing a book about failure, which I'm intimately familiar.
You're a pro.
I'm a pro. And it's about a failure to reach Mongolia from London on a charity rally that I did 16 years ago. But at any rate, I decided to go away, get some fresh air. So I went to Italy, and it was just fabulous because I was in the countryside of Tuscany. I was not in any of the major metropolitan areas. One day in Florence to see museums and Michelangelo's David, but the rest of the time I was out in the boonies riding around on a motorcycle or in my rental Hyundai i20, which was a fun.
Was that a go-kart or was that actually a car?
It was a car. The cool thing is when you rent a car in Italy, this might be true of Germany as well. Haven't been there lately, but rental cars are manual transmission usually. Mm-hmm. In Italy, because they just assume that you're competent. But I think that stops a lot of people from driving on vacation. So what you end up having is people taking the trains, Uber, tour buses, that kind of stuff. But I just had a good old time, did a wine vineyard tour, learned a lot about the history of Tuscany from the owner of the vineyard. He talked more about that than he did the wine. And then toured a lot of archaeological sites, you know, old towns from like 1200, you know, from the medieval time. Toured the Ferrari Museum, which was deeply cool because I wore all of my Carroll Shelby stuff.
Ah, there you go.
And I noticed a paucity of Ferrari vehicles from the mid-60s to the to the beginning of the 70s in sports car racing. And that's because Shelby kicked their ass every year, basically. Ford Motor Company, like, they couldn't win Le Mans. In fact, Ferrari dropped out of racing at Le Mans because of Ford, because they beat them 4 years in a row. Yeah, and they finally just said, F it, we've had enough. Or
ingrained in the movie.
Arrivederci.
Yeah,
you know, Ford, whatever.
They're done.
So it was really cool. I recommend people go off-season. If you're going to go to Europe, I could walk up to Michelangelo's sculpture, like, you know, like we're at this table. There were, you know, people there, but it wasn't wall to wall. So So there is something to be said for going, you know, not in the summer, not in the spring, but, you know, off season. My rental car was $350 for 12 days. I mean, it was, everything was discounted. It was really the time to go. So that's my travel tip today. I'm not, you know, Rick Steves, but, you know, Norm's travel tips.
Norm, traveling with Norm. Well, look.
And we'll talk about my book some other time.
We'll talk about your book, but yeah. I want to, let's shift over to Matthew, Private Palmer. So what's interesting about Private Palmer, he's sort of a history buff, and he's got all the tools necessary to go on and pursue whatever education you wanted to do, but you chose the Army.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is where you get to talk.
Well, and let me interject as a non-relative. This young man here is brilliant. I mean, he could teach at college, much less be a college student. Old viewers of this program may recall that Matt and I got in a debate when he was a little squirt. He came in here and I said something about Stalin's son, you know, Joseph Stalin, the dictator of the Soviet Union. I said something about his son being captured by the Nazis and he died in prison camp. And Matt went, no, he didn't. And we went back and forth, and he knew of another of Stalin's sons that I didn't know about. And I knew, so this guy, I mean, what were you, an eighth grader or something? I mean, it was ridiculous. Yeah. And he knew all of this stuff about history. So he's brilliant. And where I adore this young man is he decided to serve his country, okay, rather than selfishly, you know, doing what I did or his dad. We went on to college. We were going to get big degrees and earn a big living. This guy is earning
1776 last week.
Yeah. I got my warrior dividend.
He's earning chump change, and he's serving our country. And to just get serious for a minute, he's pledging his life, to defend our country. So I don't want to get too maudlin here, but at the same time, dude, I respect, you know, like,
thank you.
You're awesome.
It. Yeah, it's just something I kind of decided I wanted to do when I was in probably my freshman year, I think.
Of high school, yeah.
Yeah, fresh year of high school. And I don't know, I was good at school, but I never really wanted to try. I don't like doing homework, which is a lot of kids are that way. And when I was originally signed, I don't think I planned on going to college ever. Like when I originally like signed my contract, which would have been about January, February, my senior year of high school. But now that I've like been in a little bit and talking to a lot of people, it turns out, and a lot of people are this way, been in the Army, a lot of the NCOs I've been around have said like they all went in to kind of avoid going to college, and then they all ended up going to college while they were in the Army because it's available, doing online classes while you're there. It makes it easier, and it helps you in the Army if you like want to get into schools, get promotions, things like that. They look at the people who have college degrees first because it's – the Army just wants to see you taking advantage of the GI Bill and getting educated. They want those people in leadership positions.
What's interesting is I think we went through a phase. When did they eliminate the actual draft? In 70?
It was around 75,
76.
End of Nam there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was only 5 years old. But, you know, my dad always said this. Your grandfather always said this. He goes, there were two things that were better when we had the draft. The military was better, and then college was better because it forced everybody to sort of grow up. You didn't spend your first 2 years, if you went after high school, you didn't spend your first 2 years in college being a jackass and partying and being young. You actually grew up and learned some discipline. And then you could actually enjoy college. And then everybody went to the Army. So you got a mix of the entire populace, everybody, or not the Army, but to the service, but everybody had to go at some point.
Right.
So you just had more numbers, you had more people, you had different intellects, different areas of expertise, and you just had better both. And I think what you're describing is once you got to the Army, and I saw this transition in about 4 weeks, and it was only over the telephone. We dropped him off, we had tears, and we cried, and see him whenever. And then 4 weeks later, I talked to him on the phone. I was like, what did you do to my son? Mm. You know, did you turn this kid into a young man that quickly?
Yeah.
And they did. I think what happens is people get a little, they get a taste of discipline and what it's like to actually take responsibility, have responsibility. They give you responsibility.
Yeah, there's definitely responsibility there. It's discipline's a big part of it. It's you start having to. The biggest thing of basic training wasn't just individual discipline though. It's more like helping each other as a group. You have battle buddy system.
People dependent on you, and you dependent on others.
I don't know if y'all are familiar with the battle buddy system, but during at least Army basic training, you always have to be. You have to be with a proper battle buddy team at all times, which is either two females and a male, two males and a female, or just two males or two females. And you always have to be with a proper battle buddy team, and you always have to be with somebody. And then it kind of develops a, and if you're with your battle buddy and you're screwed up and you get smoked and have to do push-ups, your battle buddy's doing them with you. So kind of
accountability. It's
like a, hey, you miss a spot shaving, your boot.
It looks like you missed a couple spots.
Your boot laces are untucked, you know, something like that. Like something simple that you wouldn't notice that's going to get the whole platoon screwed up if the drill sergeant sees it, but they'll catch it.
Yeah.
So all that fuzz is coming off before you go back.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to be clean shaven.
So you're finished with basic, you're on leave, and then from here you go to some kind of specialty school to learn a skill, a trade, a way of doing things. Tell us about that.
So I'm at AIT right now.
Say, what does AIT stand for?
I have to look that up. I forget.
Advanced Infantry Training. I think it's
Advanced Individual Training or Individual
Training.
Okay.
Or Infantry Training maybe. But it's basically just your MOS training. It's your job training.
An MOS.
Is a Military Occupational Specialty or something like that.
Yeah. No, it's your job. I think you nailed that.
But the Army's big on acronyms. Everything's
acronym. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But I'm at AIT right now, so I'm on leave from there. It's pretty simple. It's a lot less stressful than basic. We still have drill sergeants and hit times and all that sort of thing. But instead of sleeping in one of those big rooms with a line of bunk beds and 60 smelly dudes walking around barefoot,
sure,
you get your own room and your own latrine with a shower and
a stack of manuals to study. Yeah. I'm sure.
What is your MOS then?
I'm a 91 hotel, which is a tracked vehicle repair and maintainer. So I've fix any tracked vehicles, mostly the M88s, which are like recovery vehicles, M993s, which are like tracked rocket launchers almost, and I'll end up working on some tanks eventually, but not during school because they don't have any in the shop, but we'll probably end up working on them, and I could end up operating some of those vehicles in the future.
Sure. Cool. Well, I guess you're going to have to test them.
Yeah.
So you'll have to drive them, right?
A lot of mechanics end up, they give you a vehicle to operate, so you actually will go out and be recovering vehicles in those.
But no wheeled vehicles, like?
That would be a 91 Bravo.
Okay. Wheel mechanic. Those are different, actually different specialties, huh?
Yeah, and the 91 Bravos, there's a lot of them. That might be the second biggest MOS in the Army.
So Bradley fighting vehicles.
Bradleys are tracked.
Oh, so you probably work on those. Yes. Okay.
And there's actually a 91 Mike. There's a Bradley repair specialist that just fixed Bradleys.
What's that big thing that has a V-haul? It's just a gigantic truck that they haul troops around in. It's blast proof because it has a V-shaped haul.
I know what you're talking
about. You know what I mean? But that's a wheeled vehicle, so you wouldn't be working on that. Or the Humvees.
No, yeah. Those are for the wheel guys.
Okay.
And the wheel guys kind of get stuck with the most work, and there's so many of them competing for schools and jobs that it ends up being better to do something other than the wheel mechanic.
So you're going to learn about the engines that power these vehicles?
Yeah.
Are they diesels?
They're all diesels. Diesels. Pretty much everything in the Army is a diesel.
Do you get – so everybody – I would want to know, what do you get that carries with you – outside, you have choices, right? You can re-up and make it a career, or you can come outside after you're done with the Army. And I already know the answer to this because you're my son. But when you get done, you chose a trade that you can take with you. Do you get certifications? How's that work?
I don't think you get certification civilian side, but I think the whole automotive industry as a whole is kind of moving away from certifications being important. I noticed that when I was at when I worked at the Toyota dealership, before I joined, it's certifications, especially ASE and that type of thing, are becoming less and less important. And they're more focusing on their brand specific certifications as well. But that you get, but that obviously you aren't going to have those before you come there, but they're more focusing on experience and what you know.
Because you'll adapt. Right. You'll learn their system.
And if you have been working in the Army as a mechanic, they're going to see that and they're going to know that it's somewhat.
You've got some training.
Yes, you got some training there.
And you've got some discipline.
Yes. And I feel like it could directly translate to working on construction equipment. I'm sure there's tons.
Farm equipment. Anything big and heavy with tracks.
Yeah, there's not a lot of guys who are specializing in tracked out on the civilian side, but there's a lot more diesel mechanics than there are just people who do track stuff.
Yeah.
So what's the plan? You've got, a three-year commitment?
3 years. I'm going to finish my contract and see how I feel. Well, the career counselor will come to you about a year before your contract ends, and you just have, and they'll talk to you and try and get a feel of what you want to do and
so
how you want to move on. And I'm not really sure exactly what I want to do yet, but I want to get through my first couple years and see how I'm feeling. Because I haven't even gotten to the regular Army yet. I'm still in AIT, so see how much I like it. If I want to reenlist, do an MOS change, just decide what I want to do.
So I'm going to be Normstradamus here, Nostradamus. I'm going to be Normstradamus. This show, every year on this show, we usually do some kind of half-assed predictions.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a prediction about you, long range. And we may not know until your 3 years is up. But I am going to predict that they're going to identify you as a super bright guy who they're going to try to get you to go to officer candidate school. In my opinion, they're going to pay for your college and try to make you an officer. That's what I think is going to happen.
It's definitely a possible route. I want to try and get at least an associate's degree while in this next 3 years.
Tell us how that can happen. So you're in the Army and you're going to go get an associate's degree while you're in the Army.
Just
the same degree I could get, or somebody your age could get who's not in the Army.
Right.
And you do it online.
Yeah, you just do it online. And
so you're doing two things at once.
You're going to be not going to have much free time because you're going to be doing that and then working. And
yeah.
You work a lot in the Army. They it's not easy. But
they're paying you to be there. So,
yeah, so. But it's not something a lot of people will do, and it'll set you apart because in your first contract, a lot of people are young. We're all young and stupid, and they want to go party on the weekends, not sit in their room and do classes.
Right.
So it'd help. It'd give you a leg up.
They're going to notice. They're going to notice you're bright.
Go to OCS. I think you'd need a bachelor's, but warrant officer candidates is always a thing, and warrant officers are really good for like technical stuff. Warrant officers is like the next level for like a lot of the 91 series repair jobs. Or if you want to fly, that's warrant officers.
So fly helicopters.
I'll just throw this at you. So right after 9/11, a lot of young men. Now, you were a gleam in your father's eye back then. Yeah. But when 9/11 happened, and they're flying airplanes into the Pentagon and the Twin Towers, and into that farm field in Pennsylvania, a lot of young men who were bound for college, not tons, but a lot of them dropped out of their plans to go to college and joined, enlisted as just like you, buck private, right? Went in. So a friend of mine's son did that, went into the Marine Corps as a private. And within the first year or two, they identified him that like this guy's just has more potential. So he then got his bachelor's degree, went to officer candidate school, and then he went to medical school because the military has a single – they actually have a medical school.
That's cool.
for all the – and now he's a doctor. He went in as a private just like you, okay? And now he's still with the Department of Navy, okay? But now he's a physician. Yeah. And so,
and his education,
it was all covered, because
you can't call it free because he worked for it.
No, right. He's got a contract. Yeah. I think for the medical school, it's like 6 or 8 years. I mean, it's pretty substantial. Kind of like pilot when they make you a fighter pilot, they have so much money tied up in you. It's like a six year deal,
Yeah.
So at any rate, that's my prediction. I just think you're going to be one of those bright lights that they identify. And
maybe
it'll happen organically. You're just going to do what Matt Palmer does, and that's just going to – they're going to notice that.
I think the key to getting like into like warrant officer school and those types of things is like getting some college education. That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
You got to find a way to stand out somehow because there's tons of other people who want to do it.
Yeah.
You're competing with even like NCOs who've been in the Army for 10 years. So there's a lot of competition.
But you're more malleable. Yeah. They almost like.
They,
you
know,
like when you want to be a pilot, like it's a disadvantage to already have your pilot's license.
Yeah.
They want to train you the Army way, you know, like in stripes. Where'd you get your training, son? They want it all to be their
system. You're more likely to get into officer candidate school going into the military for the first time. Like if you're just signing your contract and you have, let's say you got out of college, you got a bachelor's degree and you just sign your contract to be at a 09 Sierra, which is an officer candidate.
Yeah.
You're more likely to get in that way than to be a NCO who's got a college degree, who's been in the Army for 10 years.
You don't have any bad habits yet.
Yeah. And the NCOs, they like picking younger people fresh out of college than they – the slots are mostly those. And I will say also, I think for officers, like getting the jobs they want, doing OCS is like the hardest way to get the job you want. Because first it goes to West Point, gets their first pick, and then ROTC, and then OCS gets their pick for the jobs.
Yeah.
But obviously, green and gold is hard to do, but it's definitely possible.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think you'll, that's a prediction.
Yeah.
And if that's not what you want, that's okay too.
We'll see. Like, we'll see what happens at the end of my contract. Maybe that active duty life is something I want to do for like 20 something years. Retire.
Yeah.
I mean, you do 20 years of retire, then you're what?
Yeah, 40. You're going to be under 40. Like, remember when you hit 40 and you felt like I got my whole life in front of you? You had to have your whole life in front of you, and you're already retired.
Yeah.
And you're already getting money.
And that's what I mean. You're getting paid, right?
You get paid
as a retiree,
and then
I go work at the post office to be a triple dipper. Because after that, you're going to deliver pizzas for Domino's, and then you'll get Social Security. You'll get a post office.
He won't get Social Security. That'll be broke by then. But
yeah. I'm going to clean that out.
Yeah, the Social Security will be gone.
So, look, as a parent, let me say this.
Yeah.
I had one rule for you and your brother, and not about what you had to do, but do you remember what I told you?
Need a plan.
You need a plan. You got to have a plan. So there are parents, I think, who are thinking, I would never want my son to go to the Army. What if he gets shipped out? Whatever. Like, you got to let him go. You got to let him go. But if I think too often we parents make the mistake, particularly in this day and age, of letting your kids drift or doing things for them or whatever it is. And I only had one rule for you and one rule for your brother: be able to tell me a plan. And you know, working, I no disrespect to anybody who works in fast food, but if that's your plan, then you better be able to articulate it and say, here's my plan now, here's what I want to do next, here's what I want to do next. Not that you were ever going to complete that plan. In fact, you probably won't. But if you try something as part of a plan and it fails, or you don't like it, we'll say, then at least you know what you don't like.
Right.
And then you can come back and do a new plan. But if you do it randomly in the world, it doesn't work.
You can't just float.
That's how kids end up in the basement.
You got to have a trajectory, right?
You got to make a plan and start moving forward. And that's what you did. I couldn't be more proud as a father.
My dad used to have this saying, and I think when we were celebrating your departure, your graduation from high school, and you were going to the Army, you had your friends there and family. And I don't know, I may have mentioned this to you, but my dad had this saying that he passed down to us, kind of like your dad past his sayings. And my dad said, aim high, because you're aiming anyway.
Yeah, you might as well aim high.
You might as well aim high. Like,
that way if you fall a little bit, you're already up.
Your little winky is pointed somewhere, right? And you might as well go for the best future that you can design or imagine. And there's another saying in racing that whatever you look at, that's where you're going to go. So if you look all the time at failure, if you look at the wall or the fence or the tree that, you know, the only tree with a hay bale in front of it, you're eventually going to hit that thing. But if you look at where the checkered flag is being waved, your odds of getting there are much higher. So, you know, keep focused, aim high. And I think that's a good rule of life.
Because
you're aiming anyway.
It's so easy to slip down, because there's a lot of people that don't aim at all, and there's a lot of people that aim low.
Right.
And it's really easy to feel good amongst the people that don't aim low, or that don't aim or aim low.
Misery loves company.
And you can go wallow in that, and you'll get nowhere.
That's right.
So, like everybody, like we all don't have Elon Musk's intellect. I certainly don't.
I don't.
I don't. But everything I ever
think Matt's
did,
smarter than
I don't. I don't have. Oh,
nah, he's an idiot. You don't know anything about it. But
he's pretty damn smart.
Like it's not luck that people succeed. It's not. People aim high. People have a plan. People move forward and say, "This is what I want to do." I remember somebody. I was just starting my career as a lawyer. Somebody says, "Why do you? You know, what makes you such a great lawyer?" And I thought about it for a second. This was sort of a joking with my partner at the time. He goes, "What makes us so great?" And I just looked at him and I said, "Because we say we are." And then we fulfill it.
That's right.
So what I was really saying is we have that goal.
That's right.
And we're gonna backfill it with steps to be great at this job. And I'm not tooting my own horn that I'm great at this job. Sure. But that was the goal. I wanted to be great at this job. And so that meant we do the extra work, you spend the extra time, you go, right. You know, you put the hours in, or maybe it's an extra phone call with a client, whatever it is.
Yeah.
We wanted to be great.
Yeah.
And we pursued that. And that's do you remember when I picked you up, what your drill sergeant said to you?
Do great things.
Do great things, Private Paul.
Love it.
Yeah. So, and he meant what he's saying is the same thing your dad told you.
Yeah.
Aim high. Do great things.
Right.
Don't just, you know, earn this.
Right.
Don't just slip in with the masses.
Right. Because your goal might be to climb Mount Everest, and maybe you can't afford to go to Nepal and climb Mount Everest, but maybe you'll climb Mount McKinley, or maybe you'll climb, you know, Half Dome.
And it doesn't mean that one job is better than another. No. So if your job is, whatever your job is, do it great.
Yeah. But if you're not aiming for the apogee, then you won't even get near that.
Yeah.
You know, you'll just settle. And settling, when you get to be my age or even your dad's age, if you've settled in life,
It's the biggest regret. And there's a couple things I've settled on. And you look back and say, man, I should have.
What a regret.
Push.
Yeah.
Right. I think the big thing isn't just having a plan. I think almost everybody has a plan. I think the big thing is actually just doing it.
No. This is where your youth has blinded you.
Well, I've noticed.
Most people don't have a plan. Most people are drifting.
They have a short-term plan.
And they just say, well, I'm going to go do this, and we'll see. You know, it's
I think people have a plan. They just don't follow through. There's
well,
always,
that could be.
I think there's a big factor of, like,
then they're not committed.
It's not
to
a
plan.
Real, like, yeah. I think the thing is you need to have a plan, but you need to commit to it. And there's a lot of people.
Not a fantasy, especially a plan.
I have friends, and I see the difference. I have friends who, a lot of us just graduated. I have a couple friends who are graduated this year. High school, that is.
Yeah.
And, My buddy Michael, he graduated, got engaged, moved into an apartment, got a full-time job, like, he's adulting. And then I have another buddy who's just sitting at home, working fast food. He plans to join the Army, but nothing's really coming out of it, and he needs
a plan.
He's floating.
He has nothing. He says he wants to join the Army, and that's his plan, but then
I guarantee you, he has all kinds of notions and fantasies. Oh, I'd love to have a Porsche. I'd love to have a really nice condo in the short north.
Or
I'd
everybody, the kids now want the fancy
but
house.
But they got to have a
plan. But there's no plan to get it.
To get
it. Right, there's no plan to get it. And look, you said something to me, you probably don't remember.
Could open a small daycare.
We'll get to that in a second.
Hey, I like that.
We'll get to that in a second. But you said to me something, I don't remember when it was, maybe on the drive back or whatever. It's like, no, I said I was going to do this, so now I have to do it. And the insight in that comment is deeper than you think, because we are never exactly sure about what we're going to do. There's always other options. There's always other things to do in the world. You said, no, I said I'm going to do this. I committed to myself. So damn it, I'm going to do it. And you did. And you weren't sure. Like, I'm sure it was scary to go to the Army. I'm sure. But you said, I'm doing this. And then you did it. So to make your point, you had a plan and you executed. But it wasn't just a plan. You said, I want to go in and I want to learn diesel mechanics and I want to do this. So later on when I get out, you sat down at the kitchen table one time or the island and said, look, I've made a plan. And you said, I'm going to join the Army. I'm going to learn diesel mechanics. And that way when I get out, I can go to school. I think at that time you said you were going out to WyoTech.
Yeah, I was considering that. But
look, but you articulated a plan to me at 17 years old that most people couldn't articulate at 25. And it turns out you probably aren't going to WyoTech, but you took the first step. And then exactly what I thought would happen is happening. You take a first step, and guess what? There's like all these doors in front of you that have just been opened.
Right.
And you're like, holy crap. It's not just WyoTech. I can go do this, or I can be a warrant officer. I can do that.
I think doing the college degree would be better than doing the trade school, because you could get a college degree in diesel mechanics, and trade school is more focused on like learning how to fix issues, but like understanding, I think like fully understanding how the engine works and like deep levels into it and the science of everything might be more important to that, because I'm going to learn how to work on it being in the Army anyways, because I'm going to be working on them. I'm just learning by doing.
When you get home from your AIT, I'm going to have you come over and put the tracks on my Bobcat.
There you go.
You have a Bobcat?
I have a Bobcat, and I have a track kit for it, and I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. So
I don't yet, but I will soon.
I'm going to go, Matt, come on over.
It's interesting the way the Army fixes things. They have, they call them ETMs, which is electronic technical manuals, and you have to and they all have all these numbers, and they all mean something.
Yeah.
Like it's like 9-2350-something-else-something-else. Okay. And there's like a level to maintenance where it's the operator is the lowest level. Then there's the maintainers, which is us. And then there's like depot and then another level. And it's just being able to understand. And so far all we've done in classes is just like being in the classroom, learning how to navigate those and know like which repair is going
to
be in which manual. Because everything in the Army, you have to do it by the manuals.
Yeah.
Like everything has to be done the same way, the right way. That's just the way Army does it.
Yeah.
So it's really important to
standardize everything.
And it's easy now that it's all online because our instructor was telling us, like when he did it, you know, you had these huge books, you know, stacked this high. Now all I have to do is open the PDF and press Control F and look up what I need to find, and I'll find it.
Have you been in an M1 Abrams tank yet?
I have not been in an M1 Abrams.
So I have. My brother, when he came back from Desert Storm, allowed me, the Marine Sergeant, like in the depot, he was not thrilled with this. But my brother was a captain.
Oh.
And he said, well, my long hair brother is going to get in this M1A1 Abrams, whether you'd like it or not, Sergeant. So he let me inside. And it is unbelievably cramped in there.
Oh, the
so I was shocked. And, you know, they hand load that ammunition.
Right.
They don't have a loader.
There's a good reason behind that, though.
Please.
If you want to look at Russia and Ukraine, you'll see all of their tanks are getting destroyed. And they have auto loaders, and they load in about 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Right. But here's the thing. Tank-to-tank combat isn't really a thing anymore. It's kind of making the main battle tank obsolete. But tank-to-tank combat isn't really a thing, and that's what that's most useful for, so you can keep putting shells at a tank. But the problem is, if you hit an auto loader with, say, a Javelin, which we're giving tons of to Ukraine, it's going to destroy that tank immediately, because it's all it does is ignite. All you need to do to kill a tank is ignite the ammunition, and the ammunition is just out. And the M1 Abrams has something called, like, I think it's called wet ammunition storage, and it's stored in, like, a liquid inside of it. And you have to open it up, take a round out, close it, and then put it in. And it's, like, surrounding this liquid. I don't know the exact material or the science behind it, but it's not flammable. And if you hit one, if a round pierces through and goes in, it'll blow up one round, but it's not going to blow. It might even blow up the whole ammunition storage, but it's not going to blow up. It's not going to kill the crew. The crew's going to be safe.
That's amazing.
And that's so that
what's amazing is you know this.
Yeah, that is amazing.
He's talking about the Ukraine. He's talking about tank-to-tank warfare. So this is beyond typical.
People like, or you guys talk, your generation talks about the phones a lot and how much, like, oh, the scrolling, and it's not good for you. But there is a good aspect to
it. He's learned it by doom scrolling on his phone.
It's a lot of the stuff I watch is history stuff, and it's like before you'd have to get into a book, and it's like you'd read each book on one thing, and it'd take this long and this long. You could just get tons of just facts, like you learn, like it's talking about like tanks and auto, like, just from doing that. And like another thing is, like, I used to play this video game called War Thunder, which was like everything they did was like one to one with real life with their tanks and how they worked.
Interesting. Wow.
And it was like, in fact, it was so realistic that people would get into arguments online, and on the forums, and they would be in the military and playing it, and they'd leak classified documents to win their argument about the video game. But
I didn't know what to say about this.
Yeah, you just made an argument against video gaming.
Right. But it's like, but the point is,
it's
like,
a,
I learned a lot
national
about tanks.
Security risk.
I learned a lot about tanks from that, because like, you play with the Russian tanks and it's like loading like that. And you play with the American tanks, and it takes like 10, 15 seconds. So you Google that and you learn about it.
Yeah.
Well, see, the difference is you took the extra step to Google it.
Yeah,
but that's what Norm is saying. You have an inquisitive mind. You
that's
like to know
right.
things,
and you're going to get noticed.
Especially even when I watch movies, I'm always looking up like, who's this character? Like, where are they from? Or where's this actor from? What are they doing? I always love doing that. And like, all of my buddies just sit there and look at Instagram.
So Matt, a bunch of really badass army operators were shot down in their helicopters in Somalia. I'm making a little transition here, and I'd like to know a little bit about what you think. I have to tell you, from my point of view, when I heard that all of these Somalians were given, a humane temporary status or whatever it is that brought them en masse to places like Columbus, Ohio, and Minneapolis, I have to tell you, I still don't really understand it. I know it was like a Crips and the Bloods thing over there, where you got Mohammed ID'd, he's one leader, and they're fighting other gangs. And it was like inter-gang. It was like, like pre-federalizing Germany, where you'd have one prince fighting another prince for control of Bavaria or whatever.
Yeah, it was like, it's what.
So why are they here? This is the thing that just blows me away. Why, after our effort to deliver pizza, to feed them, we were on a UN mission to feed them, right?
Yeah.
And to get rid of the drug dealers that were terrorizing the common people. So we went over there with, we did that as part of a multi-nation effort. They didn't appreciate the United States being there. They killed our guys,
Killed a bunch of Rangers.
And then to reward the country, we import them. And I'm just like, why? Any notion? I've never had anybody ever explain how we ended up with all these Somalis in the United States.
It's not just Somalis; it's everywhere.
Have you ever Googled it?
I have not. I've been out of the loop with the Somali stuff. Has just popped off in the past couple of days with the.
But they've been in our community for like 20 years now,
and there's been issues, like tons of issues, because it's. I mean, they're from a different, completely different culture.
Completely,
they have. No initiatives, this is maybe a generalization.
Well, it is a general.
Well, what you're saying
is, from what I've seen, the trend is that a lot of them have no initiative to assimilate or learn anything about American culture. I don't know about you, but every time.
And we don't expect that as a country anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we used to insist that immigrants enculturate and assimilate.
Yeah.
But. We celebrate diversity. And everybody's allowed.
Under the name of diversity, we are allowing other cultures not only to come here, but flourish.
Yeah,
and
right.
What happens is they take over. And, this is the seeds of our destruction. This is ultimately the seeds of the
Absolutely.
American district. And I guess something similar happened in Rome. It's like
when you
don't assimilate into the culture, then we don't have their traditional melting pot.
Yeah.
So the idea is we would absorb some of their culture, they would absorb some of ours, and we would all be Americans.
I'll give you a micro example, Steve, and I think we've talked about this once or twice. So I know a local doctor, okay, a doctor that sees female, an OB, okay? And he, under our rules, under our medical laws and regulations, he is not allowed to see a Somali patient or an Italian patient or a Norwegian patient. They can't come in with a relative who speaks English and will interpret, right? He has to hire and he has to pay for an interpreter, a non-relative who will come in.
Under what? Some sort of Medicaid rate. Otherwise, he doesn't get paid, is what you're saying.
He does not get reimbursed for that interpreter.
But he won't get paid for the medical care either.
Medicaid will reimburse. So
If he's got the interpreter.
He's got to have the interpreter. What,
there's got to be a lever of power that forces that.
I would just refuse.
And it's just insane, right?
So
what would have happened, say, 100 years ago? An Italian or an Irish woman goes to see a doctor, right? Her brother or her child or her husband would come with her and speak the English. And eventually she would be coerced just by social expectations, not by any law, but by, like Steve said, by our
necessity.
Necessity. I feel she like would learn English.
Learn out of necessity. It's,
that's right.
But I'm so we don't confused. Make it
but
necessary.
We don't make it necessary.
I'm so confused.
Every
how
form's
would,
printed in 17 languages, yeah, and we. Yeah. It,
I don't understand
insane.
Why anyone would ever want to live in a country that you and. Because, like, I see this all the time. People move from, like, to, like, Japan, and they all, like, they try their best. People don't even move to Japan. People are, like, going to a trip, and they spend months in advance learning as much
right.
Japanese as they can.
Right.
And you're living here and don't want to learn English? Like,
right.
It doesn't make sense to me. Like, I saw a video. Someone was trying to interview them, and, like, he went, like, Smalley's in Minneapolis about the daycare. And he went to, like.
You're talking about Shirley?
Yeah. This and young he, has, he went yeah. to everyone, and he was, like. And they're like, oh, I don't speak English. I don't speak English. I don't speak English. And I'm like.
And they maybe do, maybe don't.
But it's like you're in, like I wouldn't. Here's the thing. I wouldn't go to Somalia. I wouldn't go move to Somalia and go, I'm not going to learn your language. I'm just going to, I'm not going to learn Arabic.
Right.
Or
well, you won't eat. You
I'll
will never
just,
get a ride.
Well, they wouldn't. They make it a necessity.
Yeah.
They would make it a necessity.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting about it is when people say, talk about us being a country full of immigrants. Yes, but we all become the same thing.
Right.
Americans.
Assimilation. That's the point.
This is the only country that you can assume the nationality. The only one. You can't just become Japanese.
No.
You're always going to be right. an American in Japan.
Immigration.
But here you can say proudly, I'm an American.
That's right.
I'm an American.
That's right.
That is what we're talking about with immigration. We're not talking about I'm going to take over a city and have my own culture. I don't care if it's Somali. I don't care if it's right. Japanese. I don't care if it's Italian.
And there's
I don't
some,
care what it is.
There's some like you could. There's still some culture that from other countries that come, but it's like, and it's great. And you've seen it in the past. They assimilate, but they still bring some culture. There's the Italian American culture.
Well, that's
great
right.
Example.
We had German Village,
right?
And it created a really cool
and the park
Italy
and the park
and
in German
pizza.
Village is named after a German composer, Schiller.
Schiller
and
yeah.
New York and pizza and like Little Italy and all that.
But that
stuff
became a melting
but it's,
pot.
That's but right. it's not Italian.
They
it's
all
American right. Italian.
They that's all right. wanted to become.
It's
Americans.
Not Italy,
but you don't see American Somali. It's just they don't and they spoke English. They learned English. Like I don't. It's just confusing to me how anyone would want to
well,
move somewhere and not understand that. Like, sure, you could, I guess, choose. Like, I'm not saying you have to.
I don't understand.
I'm not saying you can't speak your language. I'm just saying you should learn English if you're in America.
There's nothing wrong. I think we would all agree. There's nothing wrong with somebody from Somalia applying for immigration and coming here under whatever program.
Right.
What I don't understand about us, what is our fault as America, as a country, is whatever that program was in the ensuing aftermath of Black Hawk Down, why we imported, you know, tens of thousands of Somalians and put them in these cities like that little one in Kentucky where now the native Kentuckians are actually the minority in their own town,
right.
or Springfield, Ohio, where the Haitians went. And it just seems like... Who decides these things where they plop gigantic numbers of
right.
of whether they're legal or illegal, how they go and get assigned a city in America? I don't know. How did
well,
Columbus?
Look, I'm sure it's just they just
not
thought,
Cleveland, not
Columbus.
Cincinnati. Columbus
sure,
got selected.
I'm sure the politicians
by
just picked
who?
The farthest place away from them.
Well, I don't know about politicians.
No. There's money involved.
There's a deep state thing going on.
Yeah, there's money involved. So, and look, what really happens, we were talking about this a little bit off the air, and this is getting to the fraud that is sort of getting exposed up in Minnesota. And I'm sure, as I always say, I say it jokingly, I try to create these paradoxes. The government will find as much fraud as it wants, meaning,
right.
which doesn't make sense, right? Because
right.
there's always an end to something.
Right.
But whenever, my point is, whenever you are doling out government money, there is always fraud. And if you look for it, you will find it.
Right.
And if you don't look for it, you won't.
That's exactly
so
right.
So it's really simple. When the government took over all these charitable endeavors, whether it's giving people food, whether it's giving people shelter, whether it's giving people health care or daycare or whatever,
yeah.
when the government takes that over, then you are creating a separation from the money and the obligation.
What's Dr. Sowell always say, right? If you subsidize something,
you will get it.
You'll get more of it.
Yeah, you're right? Paying for it.
It attracts people rather than working for that thing that they can get for free. They're going to get it for free,
and yeah. Worse, there's no accountability.
There's no accountability
because what happens?
And it expands them.
People are people. Look, I'm not saying Somalis are any different humanly
right.
than anybody else.
Right.
People are people.
And they're clever.
People are clever. This is why these top-down programs always fail. It's because you're always going to find some clever human.
Right.
Not Somali.
To exploit the system.
Not Japanese. Nature. You're going to find some clever person who's going to say, I can just say this and get this.
Right.
And they might even be able to do it in a way that seems like it's legal.
Yeah.
And then what happens is the person doling out the money at the government either is blind to it, doesn't care, is on the dole, in other words, getting a kickback, or has some other incentive.
Let's talk about the incentive. So let's suppose that you're in charge of the daycare subsidy operation.
You got the checkbook.
Right? You've got the checkbook. You don't want your program to ever be exposed as any kind of failure.
Why not?
Or being lax because you're going.
It's your job.
Because it's your job, and besides, you want your budget to grow.
You want your paycheck to grow.
So the more clients,
they have no kids in the daycare.
Well, no.
I'm thinking from the bureaucrat's point of view.
From the government, how does the government end up tolerating this?
I become more important the bigger my program is.
That's right. So if the goal would be, we're going to subsidize this group of people, not just some, any group, pick a group, widgets,
right.
You know, people from, you know, wherever. If the goal is we're going to subsidize that until they get on their feet and can handle on their own.
Right.
And the person whose job is it to determine that gets paid to subsidize The person is, it's never going to end.
It's never going to end.
Government programs that we're seeing this right now, this was the cause of the shutdown.
Right.
There was enhanced healthcare benefits because of COVID that were supposed to sunset.
Which has ended years ago.
Which ended years ago.
But the subsidy's still there.
And then it became this new normal. And how dare anybody roll back healthcare subsidies?
Yeah.
Like it never ends because the people whose job it is to dole that stuff out are getting paid to dole that stuff out.
Yeah.
They're not going to slash their own job.
Yeah. Right.
So, but you know who would? This is like you and I are on, we're always tracking the same on this. You know who would? The local charity, the private charity, the church, the neighbor.
Right.
Like if I give you money to get on your feet, look, Matt, you lost your job last week.
Right.
You guys are struggling over there. You got two kids and your wife is sick. I'm going to bring you a casserole and I'm going to slip you a few $100 and I'm going to say anything you need, you come to me.
And I'm going to come over and look at your situation.
And if I
make sure you're not bullshitting
that you come home with a new motorcycle with the money that I gave you, you're not getting the money next time. You're not, because I see it.
Yeah. But you're drinking.
But the government, they can't do that because their job.
Well, they can do it.
Well, their job is dependent.
They're
not
motivated.
There's no incentive to do it.
There's no incentive to do it.
The politicians get their. That's how they, if they create failure, or if the money they give out goes ends up being to
they want to hide failure.
Yeah,
they want to hide.
And then eventually they have to hide it by putting more money, and it gets worse and worse and worse.
It's like there's so many things at play here. It's always easy to spend somebody else's money because there's no incentive to save it.
So when we originally had Doge operating at the beginning of this administration, and Musk, and for a while Vivek Ramaswamy. They identified that in Ohio, right, something like one out of every five people's on Medicaid. And your father and I just sat here and we were like, how's that possible?
20% is crazy.
That's crazy. Like, that's crazy. That is supposed to be for, you know, people who are completely
ancient. No chance of doing it.
Just no way can they meet their
expenses. Like you get what you pay for.
And that can't be 20% of our state.
Well, let's talk about the fraud and the legal stuff for a second, because what's going on now is, and this happens, the government's going to do an investigation, and they're indicting people. I think something like 80 people have already pled guilty or have been convicted, and there's going to be more.
There'll be more.
Now, whether they actually get to the bottom of it, I don't know. But I got a hunch that this is going to be catchy. This is going to spread. It's going to spread to Ohio, other states, where this crap is going on. Look, we all know it's going on.
Right.
It's going on in every state.
We all know it's going on. No question. It's going on not just with Somalis. We all know right. this kind of fraud is going on
yeah.
because it can.
Yeah.
And it's tolerated. And finally we have, and I don't see how this is even partisan. I really don't.
Me neither.
Finally we have a government who's willing to say, look, we want to help people, but this isn't helping. This is fraud. You know, and some of this money is getting funneled back to terrorists. Like, look, if that's true, we don't want, nobody should want that.
So yeah. say you're,
and it's not racist. It's not xenophobic.
No,
it's not,
no. Say
I don't care if it's an, I don't care if it's a somebody who's not Somali.
So I personally do not think the government should be doing child care subsubsidies. I mean,
no,
I think it's
wrought with peril.
But $3 million for like what does a daycare need with?
Well, let me just throw this out. Like, let's suppose that. Let's set my feelings aside. Let's suppose I am, to your dad's point, a bleeding heart liberal, and I think government should provide daycare. Why? Your dad just said it should be nonpartisan. I totally agree. If I'm a bleeding heart liberal who wants daycare paid for by the government to flourish, right, and to be, I would want it to be the most audited, cleanest program ever, so that my Republican friends could not accuse us of mm-hmm. running a sloppy program.
Right.
Because then you put the very thing, like they've just done, they've cut off all payments to Minnesota for these yeah. programs.
Right. Now you've jeopardized the people who really need it.
So now you've blown up the entire right. purpose. So you would think bleeding heart liberals would be amongst the most careful
the
with federal funding.
Look, this is classic. Because what's the defense to this? Racist, Islamophobic.
Oh yeah, they throw all that.
You know, xenophobic. Sure, right. Like, but those aren't factual or legal defenses.
Yeah,
so the question becomes: I would always answer, maybe so, and I would ask one more question: Is there fraud?
right. right.
I don't care about the motive.
No.
Last time I checked, fraud
is a crime whether you're Somali or Italian or English. Well, you're American with trace your history all the way back to the Mayflower. If you commit, if
like,
it doesn't matter what group you are, if you're yeah.
and by the way, when I say maybe so, I don't mean go be racist, right? But the point is, it's an irrelevant defense.
Right.
It doesn't matter. There is one exception. If you're targeting a certain community that's committing fraud and ignoring other people that are committing fraud, well, I got a problem with that too.
Sure.
Go after the fraud, folks. I don't care where it's happening.
Right.
I don't care if it's the whitest of white neighborhoods or right. the blackest of black neighborhoods or anything in between. I don't care if the like, look on the a great example of this would have been the COVID money that was doled out.
Yeah, the PPP.
Oh, yeah. There right. were so many.
Oh yeah,
so many established businesses.
And you know, Yost
businesses.
Has that lady who's in charge of investigating that, and she's prosecuted like 60 Ohioans.
Yeah,
for who
lots
just,
of wealthy who just, white businessmen
who
and
just
women.
Invented. You know, oh, I have this cost, and these people are going to lose their jobs unless you dump this money, and then they spend it on a boat
look,
or something.
I knew yeah. people who took PPP money, and legitimately within the regulations,
yeah.
they took the money. And they didn't need it.
That's right.
You know, their business was doing great.
That's right.
But all you had to do was show just like it's the point yeah. of bad
it's what
government
Sowell said.
Programs.
You if you're offering the money,
people will take it.
It'll get, the program will grow. It'll get out of control.
Yep.
And that's what happened.
Or Ronald Reagan say, "I'm from the government and I'm here to fix everything."
Yeah,
it's like your, the government is.
It's not the it's not the answer to the problem. It is
the
problem.
The more yeah. every government program just causes corruption.
Right.
It's a
well, the
excuse
federal,
my friends, it's a shit show. Every right. every government program that they do.
So let's talk a little bit about how it worked with. So there is this there's this investigation in Ohio on elder care,
yeah.
and apparently, if you go to HHS with all the right forms. Like your dad said, because it's all an honor system. You fill out the forms, you make the claim, and you say, oh, rather than sending mama to a state daycare facility where, you know, it's state subsidized, rather than doing that, I'm going to care for my mother in her own home, and I'm going to provide 24-hour care. Me and, you know, I'm going to move in. I'm going to be there round the clock. So in lieu of you paying a facility $75,000 a year, right, you're going to pay me. And that's a thing in Ohio. Happens. There are several people who do that. Yeah. And what they do is, right, either they don't even have elderly parents, or their parents are just fine, or their parents
are old, but they're fine.
Or whatever. They don't need care, whatever. They make the claim, they get the 75, and then they say, oh, it's not just my mother, it's my dad too. Okay, now it's 150. And then you go, oh, but my in-laws are old too, so I'm going to take care of four people. Now you're making $300,000.
Well, right? Let me tell you the flip side of this, because there's the other side is government enforcement is, I'll just give an example.
Sure.
You do home health. Matthew's got a job doing home health, and Matthew works for you. So Matthew comes in and administers your meds and makes sure your bathrooms are whatever you do. Yeah. You need help getting to the bathroom, takes your blood pressure, and he has to go bill those hours. So he has to keep a log. And the log requires him, they create rigid standards, like a log that you have to be there at a certain time and you have to do a certain thing, you have to do whatever. But you tell Matthew, look, dude, I got my sons over today. Can you come tomorrow? But tomorrow's not on your log and you're not supposed to be there tomorrow. But Matthew comes tomorrow, but then he bills it like it was today.
Yeah.
Now, Matthew's indicted. Even though he performed the service,
sure.
He's indicted.
Yeah.
Not for not doing the service, but for fudging the logs on how he does the service. And I defend a lot of those cases where the people are looking at me like, we did it.
They did the substance.
Yeah, but not
this. They screwed up the detail.
And it's not a defense. And, you know, it's and I can see it both ways, but the point is like when the government administers this kind of stuff, it always goes wonky.
Yeah.
It almost always goes wonky.
It's just crazy to me that they're worried about like that they would be worried about that, like doing a log on one day instead of the other.
Well, the idea is sort of like the Army. They become rigidly adhered to protocols.
Yeah.
Because then they can say, well, look, you know, we're prosecuting these things.
No, but then they overlook
the idea would be to avoid the other fraud that they're looking. So it's like it just they're saying they're prosecuting these things. There are dozens of lawyers in the state of Ohio whose job it is to go prosecute those things in court.
Because if
they make a lot of money doing it.
If that's happening, those people are doing nothing wrong. They're just doing the regular people.
They are doing something wrong. They're fudging the books, and they're getting convicted of felonies for doing it. And here's worse. If you get somebody like Matthew, who happens to be really good at what he does, he gets convicted of that. Now he can't do that job anymore.
Yeah, he's off the table.
Who's going to fill the job?
But are those people are those people, but they're not, here's the difference. They're still doing it. They're not embezzling money. That's a lot less bad than setting up a fake daycare and embezzling millions of dollars.
Well, that's right.
That's the argument at sentencing.
Those are people who are just like, oh, I'll just come a day later. They're just doing
it. The point is there's no good way to administer these kind of programs. Yeah. There's just not. Because the on boots on the ground, you can't legislate human nature. You just can't do it.
Right. The only thing that, the thing that they're not doing and that is being proven false because you've got Homeland Security, you've got ICE, you've got Health and Human Services doing – now they're doing door knocks and they're actually looking at these child care centers and there's no kids in them. And they have video of parents coming in the morning with their kid, you know, to be registered. Oh, I'm here. Little Johnny checked in. And then the kid gets back in mom's van and goes home, mm-hmm. right? They don't stay there. They just got there to log in, and then they leave. And they got it on video that, and then they, like your dad says, then they charge for 8 hours of daycare when there's no kids there, and the mom is getting a kickback.
Yeah,
because she's cooperating with the operator of this phony system. Yeah. So she gets, I don't know, $50 a week.
I'm here to say it's not just the Somalians doing this stuff.
No,
it's. No. Well, the quote Americans or the quote Somalis or the quote whoever. It doesn't make any difference.
It's the system.
It is the human nature doing it.
Absolutely. And
the difference
The
difference here is that this is sort of centralized in one community in Minnesota.
Right.
And it's been exposed.
Right.
So it's going to get that moniker.
And they probably, each other there's this
within their community, within their language. We got this loophole. Look, we can make all this money and send it back home.
You know.
So it's. I don't think them being Somali makes it happen. I think
I don't either.
I think them human makes it happen. And the government being the government, what it is, trying to administer this nonsense,
makes it happen.
Uncle Sap, right. So look, let's
they moved here, and then there's nothing wrong with immigrating.
We permitted it.
And then they didn't assimilate, so they want to be Somalis. They don't want to be they just want to live in America and have all the benefits. Then they want to manipulate our system
and use
our government tax
dollars. I'm blaming us.
Me too.
For tolerating that.
Yes, me too.
And we tolerate it. We tolerate it because we're afraid of being called racist, or we're afraid of being called Islamophobe or whatever.
Waltz did
nonsense.
He did not dump, you know, this human wave of people into Minnesota.
And then didn't, I don't even care about that. But if you would have done that and then not paid for what we're getting, which is what we did.
Yeah.
You know, if we had just said, look, you can come here, but you're going to figure it out.
But here's where
we'll help you where we can.
Here's where I'm at, guys. I want to know, and this has never been explained, I want to know who at the State Department or where in the bureaucracy did they decide Minneapolis, St. Paul's going to get these Somalians and Columbus is going to get this large group of Somalians? Why not Wheeling, West Virginia or Bismarck, North Dakota or like... Who selects these communities?
If you know, please leave in the comments. Yeah, because, Norm wants to know.
Because I think that's a scandal. Because I don't recall the citizens of Columbus ever getting a plebiscite where they could decide, do we want to host 20,000 or 30,000 or 50,000 Somalis all of a sudden en masse coming to Columbus, Ohio? Do you want that in our community?
Like, I remember.
Now, hold on. If I want to open up a lawnmower repair shop in Columbus, I got to go through all kinds of hearings.
Right.
But you can import 50,000 Somalians into our community, no hearing, no notice, nothing in the paper. They just land at Port
Columbus.
And
I remember like when DeSantis, this was a while back, I think this is when Biden was still the president, but DeSantis got a bunch of illegal immigrants just dumped in Florida.
Right.
And he was like, where did these, like, I had no idea these people
were
coming.
How did it happen?
Right. And he said, screw it. And he sent them to the Democrats' backyard.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like,
Abbott did that.
He was just making a point. It's my job to keep the show on track. And we're getting on. We've got to keep it going. So I want to take some time.
Absolutely.
Talk about good and bad and predictions for the new year.
Okay.
So Norm, what's good and bad?
Well, I think at long last, Elon Musk is having his day because he said, we should be able to cut about 15%. Now, that was a little ambitious, but God bless him for thinking big. After all, he is one of the most brilliant people. Yeah. 15% of the federal budget should be able to be cut. And we can get rid of our national debt, you know, get rid of these annual fights over the budget. There'll be plenty more money, you know, if we cut the waste, fraud, and abuse. And he's having his day right now. So I would say that's good. My prediction is that a lot of this talk about affordability, which has suddenly become politically sexy to talk about, which I think is
because it's a nebulous, undefined
term.
Right. Nothing's ever affordable if you want it.
Well, and Steve and I would go in, if we were to look at somebody's home budget, assuming they even had one, but if we were to analyze people's spending habits, Americans spend money on things that are totally unnecessary, that are luxuries, that are wasteful, that even hurt their health, you know. And basically, you should be able to live on somewhere around, you know, $75,000-$80,000 a year if both couples, you know, both people are working in the house. It's ridiculous to me to say that they can't sustain themselves. They're
people
just not
a lot less than
they're
that,
not living within their means.
Look, I'm not going to say that that's enough money or not enough money. I'm not going to say that. But what I will say is this. Affordability has become a political term that has no real definition.
That's right.
Because gas has always been, man, how much that costs for gas. Like,
when
boy,
have people not bitched about gas?
That's right. So there's always something that costs too much.
Right.
Or we feel that it costs too much. But so it's become this political trope. The good news is the economy is sort of corrected itself. The inflation is down. It's not completely down to where we want it, but things are sort of moving in the right direction. And part of my prediction for the future is that the Republicans are in grave danger of losing the midterm election because of this concept called affordability. And I think if the Republicans are smart, they need to be way ahead of this problem now. It's the economy. It's the economy. Start getting the message out in very simple terms. I'm not a pro. I don't know how you do that. But if they lose, it's because of this. And with all the tweets and all of this and all of that and the Rob Reiner tweet, like all that's nonsense. The message should be, look, here's where we're going economically. And if we don't get this thing turned around fast, I predict, and I think I'm going to predict, we lose the midterms. And if we lose the midterms, we being the Republicans lose the midterms, then the next year and a half is going to be
impeachment Trump again.
Hearings. Right.
I mean, it'll be the third impeachment.
That's
for
it.
What?
Which,
well, it didn't matter.
They'll
last
make
time.
Something up.
Well, yeah, again. Exactly.
Yeah, it won't matter. They'll go out. It'll just be one hearing after the other and a bunch of nonsense again and nothing getting done. And look, maybe that's a good thing in the long run. Maybe it's not in the long run. I don't know. But that's sort of what I see happening coming up
that'll
in
be a
2026.
Yeah, if that happens. So, I hope you're wrong.
I think like something I've noticed is just in general is like my generation, we've been steadily getting more and more liberal, I guess you could say, like through the generation. I think my generation specifically, these last, like the 2000, born 2006, like 2008, 2009, is far more conservative than a lot of people know. I think this next year we're all turning to 18. We're all going to be voting now. And I think there's, I will say, like, even like almost every man I meet my age is more conservative than they are liberal. It's something that
quietly so too, not
it's
really
a
out
big
there.
Shift
kind of a Charlie Kirk thing.
It's a big shift from what we've seen in the past, and it's a big shift. But it's like we're all like, and we all joke around, or it's like, you know, you pretend to be liberal when you're like to get the girlfriend, but you know, but it's like a lot of
pretend to get a girlfriend. It'll end up with a breakup.
That's just
I get you.
But, I know what you're saying,
but it's like we're all, almost everyone is. Yeah. You know, with some exceptions, almost every male I met in my age is conservative.
Well, you're tired of being blamed for everything,
and
you're the bad guy, and it's all about immutable characteristics that were never in your control. You're a man. You happen to be of a certain ethnicity, and somehow that makes you guilty of something. And I think young men, black and white, Spanish, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. They're sick of being told.
Yeah, young white men are tired of being told there's something wrong.
Well, even black men.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a problem, right? They're being blamed for everything within that community. And I think young black men are you know, many are turning Republican or at least conservative. And they're sick of being blamed for everything.
And I will say, especially young white men, we're tired of it. And it's like there's a huge shift. We're done with
it. It is a huge shift.
We're done with, like saying, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, and, like, let me, like...
I'm sorry I was born?
Yeah, I'm sorry, like, we're so bad.
I caused slavery.
We make fun of that 2020 stuff where it was, like...
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Like, there was, like, white people, like, bowing down and apologizing to black people. I'm like, what did you do?
Kneeling.
I was, like...
Over George Floyd.
Yeah,
I was, like... Formula One races.
I'm like, you're not... It's like there's a big shift, and it's stupid. We make fun of that stuff, and it's like we're done with it. We're fine with who we are, and like we like cars, or we have culture, and we're proud of our culture. We don't have a problem with anybody else, but it's like we're not going to apologize
for being you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So one more good thing I got to talk about. I am. When I was a kid, my dad read incessantly and still does. Always a stack of books on the nightstand, a different stack of books on the coffee table, in the back pew of church. He always had a novel in the back of the balcony of church. He was always reading like a Clive Cussler novel or something.
Robert Ludlum.
Yeah, always reading hard history novels. Just in verse. Among the books on the shelf in the basement was a series of books by a guy named Alan Eckert, The Frontiersman. And it's basically about the settlement of the Northwest Territory, Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and then beyond. And I'd like to say I read all those as a kid. Maybe I started some, didn't finish. But I've got this new goal. Right? I'm gonna read them all again for the first time.
There's a lot of them. He was prolific.
And it is phenomenal. I'm reading The Frontiersman again right now. It's phenomenal. All about a guy named Simon Kenton and his story. But anyway.
A real dude. It's not fake.
Yeah. Kenton, Ohio, named after him.
Yeah.
So anyway, go check out The Frontiersman series by Alan Eckert. And then finally, Ohio State versus Miami tonight.
What are the predictions?
What's your prediction?
Well, are they going to let that kid kick again? That's what I'm
Jaden Fielding. I mean, he lost us to Michigan game last year.
That's really cruel to say he lost, but they put him in the position where he had to score and he didn't. But here's the thing. I think Ryan Day is going to do what he did last year. He's coming off, you know, last year he came off a loss from Michigan, right? And they still became national champions. So now he got beat by Indiana. And I think the thing is, he's going to be super aggressive because he's not going to want to kick. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a game like last year's national championship game where he's going to take a lot of chances.
Yeah,
and I think he's going to keep in the starters. He's not going to rotate people as much as he did.
27-10, Ohio State's going to win. I think that's my goal, or that's my prediction.
What's really ironic is a bunch of the players for Ohio State are from South Florida. They're from Miami.
So we got a little bit of a grudge match.
Yeah, a ton of them.
A little bit of a grudge match.
So it's for me. Here's the way I'm looking at it. Is I think that number one, I don't think Miami is as good a team as we are, anywhere near as good a team as Ohio State is. And maybe I'm biased as an Ohio State fan. But I think Miami, when they play Texas A&M, who keep in mind Texas A&M lost by a hefty chunk to Texas this year, who we beat. I mean, obviously you can't play that game where it's like we beat them and they beat them. Yeah. But I will say, and then when Texas A&M played Miami, Miami scored 0 points in the first half, and they won 3-0. I kind of barely pay attention to that game. But in that game, they couldn't move the ball against that Texas A&M defense. And Ohio State defense is the best defense in the country. It's a whole step up from that.
Wow, you really follow this. Good for you.
And like Caleb Downs, Igbinosa, and all these people who are just extremely good. We have Sonny and Lorenzo Styles and Arvell Reese. Our linebacker core is phenomenal. Our defensive backs are phenomenal. And Caleb Downs is the best defensive player in the country.
These are all first-round draft picks, aren't they?
Yes.
When they're seniors.
Caleb Downs is a top-10 pick this year.
Yeah.
So,
all these players, I think if I had to guess, I think in the first half we're going to jump ahead by maybe two or three possessions. And then I think we'll slow down a little bit and maybe they'll score the same thing that happened last year with Oregon or Indiana. Or Oregon or
Notre Dame.
Tennessee. I think that we're going to jump ahead and then we're going to slow down. They'll probably score like 10 or maybe 17.
Come back.
But I think it's going to end up being, let's say, 38 to 13. That's my prediction.
38-13. Lots of points. All right. Well, you heard it here first. Maybe not first, but you heard it here. Yeah. Common Sense Ohio.
38-13 and 27.
Did you have a score, Norm?
No. No, I'm not as educated on this as you guys. I have not really followed.
I don't know anything. I don't know half of what he knows, but I know it's going to be 27-10. Right. Why? Because, like we said, you got to have a goal. You got to have a plan. I just called it. And it's like my buddy who's played darts with it. He goes, I always aim for the triple because sometimes I hit it.
We cannot close the show without acknowledging the tremendous contributions of Brett Johnson. This is his last show. He's over here running the console. And Brett has been very educational for me. He's been a break on the runaway Norm boulder. As I go down the hill and the boulder picks up speed and wants to just bash through the wall, Brett has been a wonderful counterpoint to my, if you will, my unabashed conservatism, and he has added added humanity to our show, and I am going to pledge to honor you, Brett, by carrying on. I will have a little Brett on my shoulder henceforth.
A counterpoint
talking to me about, look, Norm, you may want to eliminate this program, or you may want to do that, but let's do things in a humane way. Brett is a lover of human beings. He cares about people. And that's an important thing for us conservatives to always keep in mind. Even if we claim that we're humanitarians, it's good to be reminded by a true humanitarian, which Brett is, that we have that responsibility.
Well, and then I'll also say this.
I'll miss him.
So Brett is so anybody knows about this and wants your own podcast. He has a business called Circle 270 Media.
Yes, he does.
And he produces dozens of podcasts right here at Channel 511, right here in our studio. Yeah. My other one included, Lawyer Talk included,
yeah.
And just got so busy that that's happening. Yeah. So if you want a podcast, you're either in Columbus or elsewhere, and you need advice on how to make it work, Circle 270 Media is the place to go. If you have any questions about how to make that connection, just shoot us in the comment. We'll do it. So look, wrapping it up for the new year.
Sir.
Happy New Year. We'll see you in 2026.
Happy New Year's.